You might think that a new English movie called Bait is an unlikely success. It's black and white. It was shot silently on a wind-up Bolex camera, the sound post-synchronized. It hisses and it flares. It resembles an old newsreel. It's about the clash in a Cornish village between the traditional fisher folk and the incoming city folk who want the picturesque but not the reality. It was directed by Cornishman Mark Jenkin, who recently won a BAFTA and a British Independent Film Award. Jenkin's based at Falmouth University School of Film and Television, and his method has been described as artisanal movie making, while Bait has been called a modern masterpiece. It opens in New Zealand, all things being equal, and if things will still open in New Zealand, in a week's time. Mark Jenkin is on Skype now. Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. You know, we ask each other very deliberately how we are these days, don't we?
Yeah, certainly do. Yeah, fingers crossed, all right here at the moment.
You're in Cornwall right now?
Yeah, in the very far west of Cornwall, so about as far away from you as I can possibly be whilst being in the UK, really.
Cornwall has been the situation, the scene, the location is the word I'm looking for, thank you, of all your work, hasn't it?
Yeah, I've been travelling a lot with this film over the last year, and people keep pointing it out to me, and I hadn't really necessarily thought of that before, but yeah, it is, and it's not to say the work is thematically always dealing with Cornwall, but certainly the context of where the stories I want to tell that is Cornwall, yeah.
And this particular situation that you describe in Bait is quite common, isn't it? The confrontation between the traditional way of life and the incoming, I don't know, day trippers or people who want holiday homes. You've noticed this over the years.
Yeah, the confrontation certainly every day, whether it's as explicitly spoken as it is in my film on a day-to-day basis, I'd say it isn't. And that's the point of the film, is that this conflict between that exists between different people's expectations of a place normally simmers below the surface, but sometimes it does boil over into anger, resentment and drama.
Were you surprised at all that your movie has been such a hit?
I think I'm supposed to say no, but I would say yes, I am. Again, I have thought about this a lot this year, and what the, you know, why it's become successful, and it's very difficult for me to tell why. It's obviously hit a nerve, or it hit a nerve earlier in the year in the UK, or last year in the UK when it was released. I think when I start making work, I would never start making a film thinking, oh, this is going to be something that nobody's going to want to see. I always start out making something that I hope is going to have an audience. But with filmmaking, there's so many different things that can happen during the making of the film. There's so many different things that can happen once the film's completed that can either make it a success or a failure. And I mean, I'm looking at the moment, so many people I know and people I don't know who've got amazing work that was all due to just be world premiered and go into cinemas, which is all just being pulled at the moment. And, you know, it's extremely bad luck in terms of timing. And I think we were extremely lucky in some ways in terms of timing. But that's not to undermine the quality of the work. I think the message of the film has meant that it's a kind of universal message. So I'm not too surprised that it's connected with an audience. I'm just maybe a little bit taken aback about how big the success has been.
Yeah, and it's not only the message, it's the medium, right? It's not only what you're saying, it's the way you're saying it that seems to have caught people's attention.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, that is a really funny one, because I make all of my films in that way. So to me, it's not a strange way to make a film, because that's how I'm working all the time. And in fact, there was times when I was making bait when I was thinking, oh, is this too straightforward formally? It's not, I want it to be a bit weirder, a bit more experimental. But then when it came out, at the early look reviews from film writers that came out, were all talking about the form, the way that it was made. And I think, I very quickly realized that maybe, or was reminded very quickly that it is different than 99% of films that you see. So of course it's gonna get attention for that. And I suppose I was waiting for the I have been waiting a little bit for a backlash against the experimental way it's been made, but there really hasn't been any yet. Not that I'm inviting a backlash, but people seem to be excited by the by a film that's been made in a different way, which I find really encouraging.
Do you think that word artisanal is accurate to describe the way you make it?
It's been called artisanal a few times. The first time it was called that, I did have to Google it to see what it meant. Once I had looked it up, I think it is an accurate definition of the way that I work. I like craft. I do like the physical making. I do like physical objects. I like the labor that goes into art. I do believe it shouldn't be physically easy to do it. I think there's something inherently worthwhile in work that is hard work and is physical work.
I can understand that entirely when it comes to some things, furniture. But for movies, I just can't quite make the link. Why do you think they need to be physically hard?
Well, I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I the studio I work in, there's nowhere to sit down in my studio. Most people who make films are probably, by the time they're post-producing a film, are going to be sat at a computer. And that's something I never, the more that filmmaking became about sitting at a computer, the more disconnected I became from it. And I was very keen just to be on my feet, working in a time pressured environment as well, because I hand process all of the footage that I shoot. I make my own developer. I hand process it in a little antique developing tank, and it's all dependent on time and movement. I have to be on my feet all the time. And I just think there's some, I don't know. I mean, m maybe I still like to think of myself as a working person, I suppose. And I feel that there's something in the work that's probably pretty intangible when you're watching it, but I think there is an element of that physicality that does transfer to the finished work, even though the majority of people will watch it digitally.
Reportedly, your short that you made in 2015 about Cornwall's housing crisis was shot, yes, again on a Clotwood Bolix, but also developed in a coffee solution, which sounds bizarre, but basically, as I understand it, you can develop with anything as long as you know whether it's acid or alkaline.
Yeah, I mean, broadly, I'm not a chemist, so I don't understand all the intricacies of it. But the film I made, called Bronco's House in 2015, I wanted it was the first time I'd hand processed a huge amount of negative, and I didn't want to use a photographic developer that I felt would be poisonous and be pouring that down the sink. So I did a bit of research and found this developer that could be made from instant coffee, vitamin C powder, and washing soda crystal. So and it really makes exactly the same developer as a normal photographic developer. And I've learned since it's no less harmful to the environment than using a photographic developer. And in fact, a black and white photographic developer is hardly harmful at all once it's gone through the process. So yeah, there's all sorts of experimental recipes for making your own developers, and a lot of this has come out of the industry, moving from shooting on film to shooting digitally. A lot of the information, or a lot of experimentation, has happened amongst the community of analog filmmakers who want to carry on working with film. So yeah, there does seem to be lots of different solutions you can make to develop your own film in.
So you like making things with your hands and you like staying physically connected with the process of producing this, but is it also a homage to, I don't know, new wave cinema in a, excuse me for saying so, but in a kind of a filmic nerdy way?
No, because for me it really comes from the process. I'm not looking at stuff that I want to pay homage to and then doing that. I'm more I, what I did is about 5 or 6 years, well, 6 or 7 years ago, I decided to just start working in a way that I really enjoyed, and I thought the start is. It takes a long time to make a film, and I thought if I want to keep that enthusiasm and the energy levels up when I'm making a film, I want to just be doing it in the way that I find fun. So I went back to shooting on Super 8, which is the old film format, which I started shooting on when I first fell in love with film. And from there, I thought, I got very excited about that again, and I started shooting on 16 millimeter, and then, I made Bronco's House, and I just began to realize that actually, because of the limitations that I was imposing on myself in terms of the equipment I was using, which is using black and white negative, post-syncing stuff, not shooting a huge amount of coverage, so maybe making up quite a bit of the sort of chronology within the edit rather than in the script, that I was actually creating work that was reminiscent of other filmmakers who were working under the same limitations. So it was kind of the other way around. I realized that if you put big limitations on yourself and use very specific equipment, it was kind of inevitable that you would produce work that was reminiscent of those other filmmakers who were using that kind of stuff.
And so the fact that you post-synchronize the sound is a necessity imposed upon you by the use of the Bolex wind-up camera.
Yeah, so the camera's very noisy, and it also doesn't really run to sync. So I set the camera to run 24 frames a second, but sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. So it's very difficult to record sync audio, because as soon as you try and sync it up, it'll drift out within a couple of seconds. So I abandoned the idea of shooting location sound, which was a really difficult decision. I thought it was going to be really risky to post sync everything, but I actually then really got keen on the process of post syncing. I love shooting silently because there's a lot more freedom on location. You don't have to go places that are quiet. You don't have to spend a long time making sure you're recording clean dialogue. You can just get on with the visual side of it and save the audio, save the sound till later. And also, I love bringing the actors back into the studio once the edit's done and getting them to revoice and then building up all the natural sound and everything. So, at first, it was a necessity. Now it's a choice. And in fact, I made a short film last year, which was shot on 16 millimeter film, but it was using a sync camera. So I could have recorded location sound for that one, but I actually chose not to because I got so keen on the whole post-syncing process.
I don't know whether it is the post-sync, but there's something really strange about bait. And it's, do you know what I mean? It's like they've all landed from another planet or something. There's a non-affect, like there's people are very kind of flat in their presentation. Is that a Cornish thing or a post-sync thing?
It's probably a bit of both. I mean, yeah, a lot of people have said there's an uncanny feel to the film, or a sense of foreboding in the atmosphere. And I
Yeah.
think that's sort of,
With
I
all
think
those
that's
close-ups, you've got these brooding, ominous close-ups of people's eyes.
yeah. Well, I mean, that again, that's an aesthetic that I really love, but I discovered that accidentally because I operate the camera myself as well. I want to be close to the actors when I'm so I can direct them, so I can talk to them. I want to be the closest person to the cast when we're on location. And because I'm operating the camera, if I walk up to the actor and get close to the actor, then the camera has to come with me, and that means it's going to be close up. So again, it's something I stumbled on maybe accidentally, but I you know, I think one of the great production values that you have as a filmmaker working with not much resources, the great production value is the human face, because faces are just endlessly interesting. I don't shoot a huge amount of coverage because we don't shoot with a lot of film stock, and in fact I do one take of everything, and then a safety. I don't shoot any big wide shots to cover action. I just shoot the fragments of scenes that I think I'm going to use, and then when I get into the edit, quite often there's not enough footage there to put a scene together in a conventional way. So I'll fracture the timeline and maybe jump forwards and backwards chronologically, which, and I think that coupled with the post syncing, with a lack of theatricality that I like to encourage in the actors, I think it all adds up to something greater than the sum of its parts, and it becomes something that is slightly otherworldly. A lot of critics have written about the film, said it feels like it's a horror film. It's going to tip into some sort of
It's like, you
into
remember the
horror
old
at some
Blair
point.
Witch Project. It's got that kind of rough hewn, oh my God, what could possibly happen next feel to it. How long do you get from one wind of the Bolex?
From one wine, I get 27 seconds.
And
So there's
so
no sh
no shot is
sorry.
no shots longer than 27 seconds?
No, longest. Yeah, the longest shot in the film will be 27 seconds. But I think some of the shots feel longer than that because the majority of the shots are so quick cut that the audience gets used to a quite a fast cutting rate. That then when a shot that's 25, 26, 27 seconds drops in, suddenly it feels a lot longer. It feels like a longer sort of breath or pause than it actually is.
Not only do you post-synchronize the voices, but you post-synchronize everything so that what did you use Foley methods, do you?
Yeah, so to create the edit initially, I will just do rough Foley in my studio just to get the rhythm of the edit going. So all of the sort of impacts and doors opening and all of that kind of stuff I'll do myself. But then I do work with a Foley artist later on who actually, when we're doing the final mix, replaces all my very rough sound effects and adds in or re-records beautiful Foley. But I love all that. I love building the world from the warmth of my studio, after the chaos of the shoot where you're relying on so many different things to go right, to then go into a controlled environment where you can create the sonic world without being encumbered by anything else. I'd love that process.
Do you? Like it doesn't matter if it doesn't actually sound accurate because the watcher or the listener will fill in any necessary gaps.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a really good way of looking at it. And the fact that the viewer is filling in those gaps makes them active in the process of watching the film. And if films are supposed to be communication, and by definition, communication is two way, then if the more the audience is involved in the piecing together of the story, then I think the more engaged they are. And that doesn't mean they're gonna like the film necessarily, but or sort of that everybody's gonna like it. But I think that's they're certainly gonna experience it in a more kind of active way than just sitting back and just being bombarded with messages. So yeah, I kind of love all that.
You have avoided, I suspect, deliberately telling me about your SLDG13, Silent Landscape Dancing Grain 13 film manifesto, because I think that you're probably feeling embarrassed about it. No need. What is it?
I don't know. Why would I be embarrassed about it?
Because it sounds so completely nerdy.
Oh, right. I thought you were going to say that I hadn't mentioned it because we didn't have time to read out the full title of it.
That's possible.
It's well, what it was a manifest. It was a list of rules that I wrote for myself when I made my first film on film several years ago. I'd been working digitally where I could shoot endless hours of digital footage. And at very little cost, because once the camera had been bought and the memory card had been bought, you can just keep shooting and shooting and shooting. So I thought, and I then decided I was going to go back to shooting film again. And I recognised that it wasn't going to be a simple just changing the camera. I needed to change my mindset. So I wrote down a list of rules to stop myself from shooting the same way that I'd shot digitally and shooting too extravagantly, because I knew I'd be bankrupt within 5 minutes if I shot film the way I shot digital. So it was 5 or 6 rules, like shoot black and white, only shoot with a shooting ratio of 3 to 1, shoot silently, post sync everything. And then I just kept adding rules to it. And the more I sort of thought about it, I thought this is actually quite interesting as a way of defining how you could put these great limitations on yourself and see whether, you know, you could create a film under all of these limitations. So I added unnecessary limitations, really. And then a friend of mine, I had 12, and then a friend of mine said, why don't you make the 13th? You must break one of the 13 rules, which meant you could even break the 13th rule by meaning you didn't break any of the rules. So, and then I thought, this is not, it's gimmicky in its, and like a lot of manifestos are, I think that, you know, they're slightly attention seeking. But you know, until I had that 13th rule, until I didn't involve somebody else in the conversation, I never intended to publish it. It was just going to be for me. And in fact, I can't even remember what all the 13 rules are now, but what it did do is I made a series of films according to the manifesto, which established the way that I needed to work, and that's just ingrained in me now. So I think Bait wouldn't satisfy the demands of the manifesto, but certainly the ethos of the manifesto is really within the way that Bait was made, and within Bait as a final piece of work.
People have said, of course, that it is an allegory or a parable about Brexit, which came about quite accidentally, that the suggestion that Brexit was even a thought in your mind, did it not?
Yeah, I mean, the film dates from, the original idea for the film goes back to 1999, when I first pitched the idea to a friend of mine. And so the idea that it's about Brexit is a bit of a misnomer, but I have thought about this and thought, you know, that Brexit is something that was happening 20 years ago. It was a mindset and it was an attitude. And actually the vote and the act of leaving the European Union was just the end of a generation's worth of political upheaval, really. So in some ways, when people said it's about Brexit, I said, no, it's not. But actually, anybody making anything in Britain, it's going to sit in the context of a pre or post Brexit society. Mm. So it's certainly not an allegory, but I do, you know, it hopefully it adds a little, it brings a little bit of nuance to the people's preconceptions of what Brexit is for somewhere like Cornwall.
As a matter of interest, did Cornwall vote for Brexit generally?
Yes, they did, yeah.
How has the movie gone down there? I know you premiered it at Newlyn.
It's been received brilliantly. I mean, the amount of people who, or the, you know, the cinema box office figures for Cornwall are off the scale. I mean, it's as if everybody's been to see it about at least twice. So, you know, the audience here has been incredible, incredibly supportive, and incredibly passionate about it. But as is always the case, a place where people are going to be passionate about it, they're also going to be the ones who are going to be most critical about it. And I think some people in Cornwall have been critical about it, about the portrayal of the Cornish within it, or maybe some people feel slightly compromised by my criticism of, or my perceived criticism of tourism as a thing or as an economy, which I don't think I've been particularly black and white about that.
I don't know. The guy on the boat dressed like a giant penis was a bit of a commentary, I thought.
Yeah, well, actually, he was, I mean, it doesn't come across necessarily in the film, but he was supposed to actually be local. Yeah, that was supposed to be a bunch of locals who were going out on a stag do. That was my attempt to kind of have a bit of a grey area there. I think Yeah, I mean, there's no, I don't think anybody would watch the film and wonder what side I'm on in this particular argument, if there is indeed an argument. But I haven't got any answers to the problems that or the conflict that's inherent within the film. I just want to ask some questions because I think we're very there's certainly a common it's a common idea within Cornwall in certain quarters that tourism is king of everything, and we don't often look at what the downsides of that are. We certainly haven't for a long time. Maybe that conversation's starting to happen now.
Well, yeah, I mean, you are likely to discover the downsides of that. And I suggest that they might be that if Cornwall's become dependent on tourism and there is no more tourism right now, then what's
Yeah.
going to happen?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we've got an issue right here that's happening minute by minute because
Yeah.
the Easter holidays are starting now. We've got the A30, which is the main road into Cornwall, is packed with people coming to come on holiday to Cornwall at a time when they're being advised that only essential
Is
travel
that
should
right?
be yeah. And
Oh.
we've got one hospital here. We've got 15 intensive care beds, and we've got thousands of people pouring into Cornwall from virus hotspots at the moment.
Oh, good
And
Lord.
I mean, it kind of stinks as far as I'm concerned, because there is a, I mean, essential travel is quite a subjective term, but if you have got a position of privilege or entitlement in your mind, then you can justify going on holiday as essential. And to hell with the consequences. And I think there's going to be huge questions about tourism as a thing globally, which is about time. There's also going to be huge implications for the economy here, because if indeed as has been promoted as a positive thing, all our eggs are in the tourism basket, then we're in trouble. Maybe tourism will kill off Cornwall once and for all, and in more ways than one.
What are you working on next? Something called, I don't know how you say it, Ennismen, which is Cornish for
Yeah,
Stone Island. Are you still doing that?
yeah, we are. I mean, it's officially we're shooting in May and June. Realistically, I don't think we're going to be shooting in May and June. We m may shoot it in the autumn, or maybe it might just get pushed back a year. Not really sure at the moment. It's a sort of environmental horror film set in 1973 on an island off the coast of Cornwall. And Ennismen is yeah, it's Cornish language for Stone Island, Ennis meaning island, and it's spelt men, it's pronounced main,
Ah, oh, good,
so it's
thank
Ennis
you.
main,
And it's
and main
men.
is the Cornish word for stone, which comes from menhir, meaning an ancient standing stone. So it's a film about a woman who is working as a volunteer for the Wildlife Trust here, who was spending a winter on an island off the coast, observing a very rare flower that just grows in the contaminated soil of an old tin mine. And the only other thing on the island for company is a 10-foot tall standing stone that may or may not be slowly moving down the hillside towards the cottage that she lives in.
Great, an environmental horror movie. That's just what we need at this point in our lives.
Yeah.
Listen,
Well,
I'm in.
originally when we were working, we
Hey?
were calling it a contagion movie to start with a couple of years
Ah,
ago, and we were first
ooh.
developing it. So, yeah.
As you say, I mean, this pandemic is going to make everything either, pre-COVID or post-COVID, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, in some ways, it's because I've set the film in 1973. It's kind of COVID oblivious, the plot, but obviously everything we watch from now on is going to be from the perspective of what's happening at the moment. I mean, I'm doing that at the moment. We're spending the evenings in the house because we're kind of locked down in the house here, really, watching a lot of movies. And everything I go to pick off the shelf or choose on Netflix or whatever is so loaded with meaning that yeah,
Yeah.
whether that will calm down or whether that's a permanent thing, who knows.
Just one more thing. People might not be so familiar with your leading man, Edward Rowe, who plays Martin, the fisherman without a boat. He's very famous. He's a famous comedian, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He's got an alter ego called Kerno King. And he's a bit of an institution here in Cornwall. And obviously his Kerno King persona is all based on quite broad humour, really. So it was a big challenge. He made it look effortless, turning that into something more serious and more dramatic. But it's certainly been a different, in terms of his audience, it's a big change to see him doing something seriously like that. And, I was really convinced early on that he could do it. And I think the performance he gives is staggering, really.
I was just thinking about all your tourists heading down your way. All of the restaurants and cafes and pubs are closed, right?
No. No.
As the of when then?
Some people are closing down, but there's no official government shutdown of stuff. The government has given absolutely... what the government is saying, you can interpret in any way you want. The Prime Minister says don't go to the pub, and then his dad comes on the TV and says, well, I'm going to go to the pub.
No, seriously, I think you might not have caught up with the news, and I'm sorry to break it to you, but I think Boris Johnson has said all pubs and restaurants and cafes have to close now.
Really? He's actually said they have to, or has he said they should?
I think he said that they have to. They have to close on Friday evening, so you've got they're going to close Friday night. So you're going to be left with... Sorry to break the news to you in this fashion, but you're going to be left with an awful lot
of... No, that's fantastic. It should have been a week ago.
Yeah. I think you're going to be awash with tourists not knowing what to do with themselves.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a horrible prospect.
I think you're right. It is. You know, we haven't got enough resources for the people who live here. So to have a big influx of people, it's just insanity. I mean, it's a lack of leadership and it's individual selfishness as far as I'm concerned.
It's very nice to talk to you, Mark. I hope you stay well and the best of luck.
Thanks, Kim. Mark, yeah, lovely to speak to you
thank
too.
Thank you. Mark Jenkin, who is the creator, kind of the one-man band, really, of a movie called Bait.